For another perspective on the critical 66 trial, I met with Dr. Jim Cassidy, who did a separate presentation at the ASCO GI meeting on the Xelox Fulfox aspect of the study. Dr. Cassidy began our conversation by reviewing the rationale for the trial.
Fulfox has become a standard treatment for both metastatic and adjuvant treatment, basically across the whole world. Xelox is a combination of capecitabine and oxaliplatin. Makes some sense because the intravenous bit of it is replaced by an oral component. We did phase ones of that combination, and then a phase two, which showed in about 100 patients that the response rates were very similar to what you achieve with Fulfox. So that made us set off in a big trial to try and prove that Xelox was non-inferior to Fulfox. And that was it. There was a very simple trial design to begin with, a randomised comparison between those two arms. A bit into that, along came Avastin, the data with Avastin and Folfiri. And it became very clear to us that the study was not going to continue in its standard format. We kept recruiting patients and then altered the trial design to add in Avastin or placebo in both of those arms in a 2-by-2 randomization. So it turned into a relatively complicated study in actual fact, but a large one, 2,035 patients, in order to try and answer the two questions. Is Xelox non-inferior to Fulfox? And does the addition of Avastin to either of the two regimens add something? We presented at ESMO the answers to that. Both of those co-primary objectives were met. So Xelox was non-inferior in terms of progression-free survival. And Avastin did add something to the chemotherapy regimen in comparison to placebo. And so we were quite happy with that, you know, two positive answers from a trial.
And what are you presenting here?
So what we're presenting here, at ESMO, we presented progression-free survival figures. The data that we unraveled at ESMO, we actually only got a hold of about 2 weeks before the actual meeting. And so the analysis were done very quickly. We didn't yet have enough events in order to be able to say what the overall survival statistics were. We also didn't have the response assessment data because we had response assessment by the clinicians but not by the independent review panel. So we've got some additional information to discuss at this meeting. So I'm going to talk about the Xelox Fulfox comparison. Len Saltz is going to do the Avastin plus or minus because it's actually too complicated to try and make into one presentation. It's actually a very complex study, in fact.
And can you kind of go through specifically what was seen in terms of both of those questions?
Yeah, so for the non-inferiority question, there's about 1,000 patients in both arms of that Xelox versus Fulfox, and the hazard ratios are very similar to each other. And there's absolutely no chance statistically that there is an inferiority of Xelox. And so we're quite confident. We're even more confident now. We've got overall survival statistics to back that up. So we're quite confident that Xelox is non-inferior to Fulfox. To all intents and purposes, it's the same. The lines cross each other. Depending on the populations you use, the intention to treat population or the eligible patient population, as it's called, the lines are slightly different one from another. But in essence, you could put them all on the same graph. So we're pretty happy that Xelox is non-inferior. The other bit, of course, about trying to pick a winner out of these is what's the side effect profile? Because clearly that's important. And here what we've got is that, in my mind, there isn't a clear winner to that discussion. And what you end up with is a bit more diarrhea, about double the amount of grade 3 and 4 diarrhea, from 10% to 20% with the Xelox regimen. But you get much more neutropenic problems with the Fulfox regimen. Now, neutropenia is largely asymptomatic with no consequences in the Fulfox regimen, but about 5% of patients get grade 3, 4 neutropenia, in other words, the more serious grades of neutropenia, against only 1% in the Xelox. Everything else, all the other side effects, are actually very similar one to another. So I find it difficult to pick a winner based on efficacy, because there isn't any difference really, and I find it difficult to pick a winner based on the side effect profile. It's a trade-off, one side effect profile against another. What swings it for me is what we started off with, which was the hypothesis that this would be a simpler treatment for patients. It would be easier to deliver. It would have all of those convenience bits to it. And of course, it does have all of those. So for me, that's what swings it. That's what makes the Xelox regimen the better regimen to pick.
What would be the explanation for the neutropenia?
The neutropenia has been seen with the Fulfox regimen in all of its different trials.
That I mean, as opposed to Xelox, though?
Who knows? You know, the infusion of 5-FU presumably has a synergistic effect in the marrow with oxaliplatin, whereas capecitabine doesn't. And because theoretically, at least, you shouldn't be able to convert capecitabine so efficiently to 5-FU in the marrow. So you can make, you know, plausible biological explanations for that. But certainly within the trial, those two bits of toxicity data match with what we've seen with FOLFOX before, and they match with what we've seen with Zelox before. So we weren't terribly surprised by them, in fact.
What fraction of these patients were from US and non-US, and what dose was used?
Most of the people ended up being outside the US. The reason being, when we started the trial initially, we had centres all over the world, and the US recruitment was high. When Avastin became a registered drug in the US, it became difficult to randomise patients. So the recruitment from North America reduced in that second part of the trial. So that meant that the proportion of patients from the US was consequently much less. The Zelox dosing is the standard Zelox dosing of 1,000 milligrams per meter squared of capecitabine and oxaliplatin at 130 milligrams. And the FOLFOX regimen, the FOLFOX 4 regimen, is the standard FOLFOX 4, 5-FU flunic acid with a bolus on both days of 5-FU, and oxaliplatin 85 milligrams per meter squared given every 2 weeks. So obviously there's a difference in the scheduling, a 3-week schedule versus a 2-week schedule.
What's your take on this issue of, you know, European and non-European toxicity of fluoropyrimidines, and particularly the presentation at last year's ASCO about that?
Right, so I've been involved in that analysis, and what we've done is to collect all of the data that we have on capecitabine and actually on the control arms, the fluoropyrimidine control arms, and try to assess in a more sensible way whether the toxicity profile is different in the US versus the rest of the world. I have to say that I've had to eat humble pie, because initially I thought that there probably wouldn't be a difference, that the difference was a reporting or a standard of practice type difference. It turns out that's not the case, that there is a real difference. The US population seems to have more toxicity from fluoropyrimidines, not just capecitabine, but 5-FU as well, in the form of diarrhea, mucositis, hand-foot syndrome. There are many potential hypothetical reasons why that might be: folate status, nutritional standards, a whole bunch of different things that might account for that. So we've got some theoretical arguments as to why that might be, but we haven't really pinned down the reason for that difference.
So for practical purposes, do you think that patients in the United States should be dosed lower? And if so, does that cause concern about efficacy?
I've always had a concern about the business of trying to reduce the dose, the initial dose of the chemotherapy, exactly for the reason you've just suggested, that if you go in with a lower dose in all of the patients, then presumably what you're doing is underdosing a proportion of patients. So my take on it is that I go in with the standard doses, and then if I have to, I reduce the dose. As I said, I've eaten humble pie on this, so I do have some sympathy now with the idea that perhaps you should go in with a lower dose and assess how the patient is, and if they tolerate that, then maybe one might escalate the dose in those patients. I find that more difficult to do with patients, more difficult to explain to them that you've not had side effects and therefore I'm going to increase the dose. Seems illogical to most of the patients that I try and explain that.
Can you talk about the bevacizumab part of the trial that's being presented here?
Sure. So the Avastin part of the trial showed that there was an advantage to the addition of Avastin, both for the combination of chemotherapies. There are some subset differences. So when you look at the Zelox arms of the study versus the FOLFOX arms of the study, there are some differences which we presented at ESMO. And the difference essentially is that it appears that there's less benefit for Avastin with the FOLFOX regimen than there is with the Zelox regimen. We think that's a statistical trickery. By chance, there are some patients in the FOLFOX arm who are very good prognosis patients, and we think that's what's swaying that bit of the study. The other bit that causes some people concern is that the quantum of benefit that you see with Avastin with the oxaliplatin-containing regimens here is less than was seen in the original Hurwitz data.
Can you talk about those numbers more specifically?
So with the Hurwitz data, it's about 4 months. With our study, it's about 1.5 months in terms of the absolute median difference in progression-free survival. When you stack them against other trials with Avastin, they are actually within the kind of envelope of statistical possibility, but they're at the lower end of that envelope. There's no doubt about that. And we've been looking very closely at reasons as to why that might be. The best hypothesis we have at the moment is that although the protocol was written that when the patient stopped an element of their chemotherapy, you could stop the oxaliplatin because of neuropathy and continue the 5-FU and Avastin, or vice versa. If you stopped the 5-FU, you could continue with the oxaliplatin and Avastin. And what actually happened in real life in the trial was that in the majority of patients, when the chemotherapy stopped, the Avastin stopped. And that happened at around 6 months for a large proportion of the patients in the trial. When you contrast that with what happened in Hurwitz trial, because the rules were very similar in the Hurwitz trial, what happened there was that most of the patients actually continued the Avastin for longer. And they continued the Avastin, in fact, until progression. Whereas in the 66 trial, many patients stopped the Avastin before they progressed. It's even more difficult to explain that, because when you look at the Avastin-specific side effects, they're actually not very high in the 66 trial. Numerically, they're lower than has been seen in other trials, but yet the removal of patients from chemotherapy because of adverse events is higher in the Avastin-containing part of the trial. So there's a sort of a mismatch there that I'm not entirely sure that we can explain that. You have to put this into the same time frame as what was happening with the rest of the world. So what was happening in the rest of the world was that business of chemotherapy-free holidays was becoming more acceptable. The data was emerging from the Optimox studies that probably it was not of great detriment to the patient to have holidays from chemotherapy. And I think that has influenced the clinicians in our trial, and they've been influenced into saying, okay, so we'll give the patient some holidays from chemotherapy because that doesn't look like it's bad. And what they've done is stop the Avastin at the same time, because I guess patients have said, well, it'd be good to be off treatment, completely off treatment. And therefore, the duration of Avastin in our trial is less than the Hurwitz trial, and that then makes the progression-free survival time less. Now, that's all hypothetical, I have to say. I don't really want to sort of pin my colours to the mast and say that's the reason for this, but it's at least a plausible potential explanation for what happened.
Well, how do you approach these patients in a non-protocol setting in terms of that issue?
So what we would do is continue patients till progression. When patients get oxaliplatin neuropathy, and then we dose reduce the oxaliplatin and we discontinue the oxaliplatin, and we would continue with the fluoropyrimidine part of the treatment and the Avastin part of the treatment. And that makes good sense. It will be interesting to see what we're going back in and analysing more of the data from the 66 trial to try and find out just what did clinicians do and why they did the things that they did within that trial. We've been kind of spoiled with the Avastin trials up until that trial. I mean, the studies that had been done previously had all shown very marked increase in progression-free survival. And we had got ourselves into the mindset that this FOLFOX-Xelox regimen would do the same. And everybody became very disappointed with the idea that the level of benefit wasn't as large. I actually think we've kind of spoiled ourselves with this. And it's interesting, if you look at the history of other trials in oncology, often new agents show big benefits to begin with. And then as more trials are done, bigger trials are done, the level of benefit actually does reduce. So I just wonder whether this same phenomenon is happening with Avastin. And what we're seeing with the 66 trial is actually more like real life. You know, the level of benefit from the Hurwitz trial was actually somewhat higher than might be expected in standard practice. It seems to me that's at least plausible.
What other clinical research efforts and studies are you involved with right now?
We're doing the second of the zaliprodin studies. You might remember I presented the zaliprodin data before, looking at zaliprodin as a potential neuroprotector for oxaliplatin. So we're doing the second of those trials, which is essentially a confirmatory trial, but trying to answer or address some of the issues from the first trial that we, in retrospect, we probably didn't design that trial as well as we might have done. So what we've done in the second trial is to continue the zaliprodin for longer and to look much more closely at the neuropathy. So we have neurophysiological testing within that trial, which will, I think, nail down that whole question much more tightly.
Can you talk a little bit about what exactly zaliprodin is and how it's hypothesized to work and what we know about it at this point?
So zaliprodin is a drug that potentially is a neuroprotector. It was designed initially for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, was actually the initial disease condition in which the drug was tested. It didn't work very well in that particular condition. It's also been tested in Alzheimer's disease, and the results of that are not yet known. The trials are ongoing. So there's a potential neuroprotector. And in the model systems of oxaliplatin and platinum-based neuropathy, the drug was very active. And that's what set the ball rolling in terms of trying to do the clinical trials. And of course, the advantage to that would be if you had something that stopped oxaliplatin's neuropathy, then you could do two things. One is you could give more oxaliplatin, and that might mean that you had more activity. The other is that you could give the same amount of oxaliplatin and avoid the neurotoxicity. And I think both of them are things which are sensible and reasonable to do. What we chose to do was not to try and get more oxaliplatin in, but to try and get the same amount of oxaliplatin in, but reduce the neuropathy.
What do we know to this point about the ability of this substance to prevent neuropathy?
So that first trial showed that there was a reduction in the grade 3 neuropathy. What happened was there was an increase in the grade 1 and grade 2 neuropathy and a reduction in grade 3. So it looked like you shifted patients into lower grades of neuropathy. The controversial part of that trial was we didn't look at the duration of neuropathy after stopping chemotherapy. So could you shorten the recovery period for the neuropathy? We didn't look at that, and we need to look at that in the second part. Of course, the other thing that we did, and we did actually very satisfactorily, was to show that there wasn't a decrease in the activity of the chemotherapy. Because anything you add in that stops toxicity, you know, oncologists worry about, yeah, it stops toxicity, but does it stop the drug from being active? And the first trial, we definitely convinced ourselves that that was not the case. There was no difference in the activity profile. So zaliprodin is an unfinished story. And the next trial should give us, it's a bigger trial, being done, as I say, with more detailed neurophysiology. So it should give us a definitive answer to that question about neuropathy. What it won't do is give us the business of how would you use such a drug? Would you use it to give standard dose oxaliplatin but just ablate the neurotoxicity? Or would you use it in the other way to dose escalate oxaliplatin and then try and get more activity out of the drug? And I think that's an open question. And if the drug works, then I guess we'll attack both of those questions.
I know you're participating in the AVANT trial. Can you talk a little bit about the design of that study and what your experience has been putting patients on it?
So the AVANT trial is looking at the FOLFOX regimen again, plus or minus Avastin in an adjuvant setting. And we've put quite a number of patients into that trial. Clearly, the FOLFOX part of it is pretty standard, and you know, no one worries about that. The addition of Avastin, of course, we worry about in one way, in that the toxicity profile adds something to the toxicity of the chemotherapy. And we worry about, to some extent, the long-term effects of Avastin. Because in a metastatic population, that's not a concern. But clearly now, when you move into the adjuvant setting, that is of some concern, because there's a good proportion of those patients who will be cured of the disease, and one will see those long-term side effects that we currently don't know anything about. So we're not there yet. We're enrolling patients. The patients, many of them are still on Avastin, because the duration of Avastin is 2 years. So many of them are still in the trial, still being given Avastin. For what it's worth, our experience is that the Avastin patients are not suffering from overt, terrible toxicities. They're coming in, having their Avastin, going home, and not really having a lot in the way of problems. But of course, it's very early days. And you know, the long-term side effects I'm talking about might be 5 or 10 years from now before we could be sure of them.
Of course, the other arm in that trial, you have the FOLFOX plus or minus Bev. There's also a CAPOX Bev arm.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that aspect of the trial?
So, I mean, it's the same hypothetical argument as we've had with the 66 trial. You know, can you do the same thing with the Zelox regimen as you can with a FOLFOX regimen? I think that the answer to that question we probably know already. I think the 66 has answered that, that there's unlikely to be any difference between those two, and that there's probably no interaction between them and the Avastin-containing part of the chemotherapy. So I reckon that in the end of the day, what the AVANT trial will give us is whether or not the addition of Avastin actually makes a difference, rather than a clear-cut answer about the chemotherapy.
You mentioned the question about long-term safety issues with Avastin. What specifically are your concerns?
I don't know is the answer to that. If you look at what happens in the short term, like proteinuria and hypertension, I guess then you begin to think, so maybe there'll be problems with the kidneys long term. And I've heard reports of people saying that there's fibrotic reactions in kidneys in some patients. Now, these are very much anecdotal, sort of one-off, you know, bumping into physicians in the corridor type discussions. But clearly that's something that we need to keep an open mind about. You know, do you get long-term organ-specific side effects? And those organs, I guess, would be those in which the angiogenesis pathway was really important, like kidneys and probably eyes. But I guess we have to keep an open mind about side effects in other organ systems that we could not predict.
What other clinical research trials are you putting patients on?
We are currently enrolling patients in a pamitumumab study, which is our first-line FOLFOX plus or minus pamitumumab study, which is just underway. Pamitumumab being the next-in-line EGF receptor antagonist.
What's your take on panitumumab and where you think it's heading?
So pamitumumab, as I said, is next in line in the EGFR antagonist story. It looks, from the data that I've seen, it looks very much like it will be very similar to cetuximab in terms of efficacy parameters. But it does have some advantages. Because it's fully humanized, you don't have the same instance of allergic and anaphylactic reactions, which can be a real problem with cetuximab. Just anecdotally, the very first patient that we treated with cetuximab, an anaphylactic reaction, which of course puts everyone off, you know, using the drug. If you see that just once, that's enough to frighten everybody. Pamitumumab doesn't have that. It also has a different schedule of administration. It's every 2 weeks rather than every week, which has some advantages. I don't actually think that that in itself would be enough to change over from one drug to another drug. But when you add that into the business of having less anaphylactic reactions, then it might be enough. But clearly, pamitumumab is behind cetuximab, so it has to prove its efficacy just in the same way as any other drug. It looks like it has all the class effects, so it produces a rash just the same as cetuximab does. So it looks like it will be active, but it's how active and what the trade-off is in terms of side effects.
What do you think things are heading in terms of double biologic therapy?
So the double biologic therapy discussions and trials are now coming through. They're largely being done in the US environment. And that, I guess, is because the cost containment issue is not quite the same in the US as in many European countries in particular. The trials look pretty interesting. I mean, it does look like you get extra bang for your bucks when you add these drugs together. And that's maybe what you would expect because of the different mechanisms of action. My own take on it as a European oncologist is that they're going to have to be dramatically better than what we have with other things in order to allow us to use those combinations in our kind of standard clinical practice. And we will participate in clinical trials built on that premise that you can give more than one targeted therapy. But I doubt very much that we'll be in a position anytime soon to use those drugs in that way off protocol.
Do you think the difference would have to be dramatically different in order to study it in the adjuvant setting?
It's a good question. I mean, clearly the attraction of doing that is if you could take away the cytotoxic component and what you could give was, in inverted commas, targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting and not have the long-term effects and the short-term effects of chemotherapy, then there might be some theoretical advantages, and they actually might be very large advantages for doing that. I think that will be something that's quite difficult to do. The reason being that we don't really know yet that any of these work in the adjuvant setting. If the AVANT trial is positive and the cetuximab adjuvant trials are positive, then I think one could go in that direction. I think it's at least theoretically possible that neither of those two trials will actually be positive, in which case I think that whole thing will take a bit of a dent in the adjuvant setting. The metastatic setting, I think, is different.
Can you talk about some of the new agents that are coming along? And I'm particularly interested in AZ2171.
Yeah, 2171, or its new trade name is Rucentin. 2171 blocks the three VEGF receptors, so it's a bit different from Avastin. It doesn't sequester the ligand, it blocks the receptors. And that theoretically has some advantages, and certainly in model systems it looks like it does have some advantages against Avastin. It's much more early in its development pathway, obviously. There are trials planned and ongoing, the Horizon trials they're called, looking at first-line addition of 2171 to a FOLFOX regimen, and looking at the second-line, looking at two different doses of 2171 versus FOLFOX plus Avastin. And then further on in the development pipeline, there are plans to produce a trial which will be essentially a straight head-to-head FOLFOX Avastin versus FOLFOX 2171, which, I mean, all of these make sense. I mean, that's the way the drug will have to go into in order to be developed in this disease. It's quite a big ask, you know, so it will be interesting to see whether the drug actually makes it through those different parts of its development pathway. And AstraZeneca, who are developing the drug, have clear go, no-go decision points in that whole plan in order that they can then decide whether to go ahead and do all of those trials.
Can you talk a little bit more about exactly how the drug works, how it's administered, and what the side effects are?
So it's an oral compound. The side effects are so far kind of similar to what's been seen with Avastin. So there's vague side effects like fatigue and problems with hypertension, class effects that you might expect from antivascular drugs. I haven't seen anything in the toxicity profile that makes me think it's very different from Avastin. It's an oral administered drug, so it's a daily administration, clearly an advantage over Avastin for a longer term administration. Its mechanism of action, as I say, is it blocks receptors, it blocks the VEGF receptors. So it may produce a more substantial VEGF blockade than does Avastin. It's a TKI, it's a small molecule.
What other new agents are out there in colorectal cancer that you think are exciting?
There are about 52 different drugs being developed in colorectal cancer. I don't know of any. I don't know them all. I don't know all the data on all of those 52 drugs. Of the ones that I'm party to, I don't see any so far that are coming through that are, if you like, hot picks that, you know, one could say would be another Avastin or another cetuximab. They're all earlier than development in that. They have different mechanisms, and it remains to be seen whether those mechanisms will actually translate into anything meaningful in colon cancer. But it's an interesting time. You know, lots of drugs, lots of different targets. It would be nice to think that five or six of them might make it.